Today is April 16th, 2013. Recording this interview is Spring Greeny, a grad student at the UW.
And Jocelyn Mink, also a grad student at the UW.
We're in Helen C. White Library with our interview guest. Can you just say your name and spell your last name, and we'll keep an eye on the sound.
Okay, I am Kevin Gibbons. It's G-I-B-B-O-N-S.
Great. Cool. That looks good. Okay, Jocelyn, do you want to lead off with questions?
So, just to start, I guess you were co-president of the TAA, mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
During the time that the 2011 protests started. And so what was your role, basically? What did that entail, especially for planning or organizing the Stand Up Fight Back? Is that what the name of the initial thing was, or was it something else?
So part of it is what was your role before all the
right.
protests happened, and then what was the role after? And because one is really boring and, and it's sort of the standard kind of get involved with the leadership of a labor union and have everybody ignore you, and then there's sort of after, and then people have more difficulty ignoring you. So beforehand, as co-presidents, our main duties are to kind of coordinate a lot of meetings, set agendas for what the union's going to do, in terms of bargaining, in terms of doing contract enforcement, managing the finances of institutions so that it stays solvent. Organizing, helping to organize campaigns. But it's a pretty horizontal organization, which is why I mentioned some of that, in that you have a stewards council that does a lot of the organizing events and plans to, get members to sign cards or does parties. You have a bargaining committee. You have a contract enforcement committee. So a lot of times as co-president, what we did was to coordinate kind of executive board meetings to get people to talk about things, lead general membership meetings, pretty mundane things that can be sort of unrewarding at times. But it's a good job. It was fun for a little while. Mm. It's certainly a distraction from graduate school.
Yeah. The sort of sexier part, what motivated you to get involved initially?
I think I started in the TAA when I was a grad student in 2007 because somebody asked me to. And they said, hey, you should come out and you should come to a bargaining team meeting. And so... And I was interested to hear. I didn't have strong opinions about labor unions before coming to graduate school. I mean, I'm from Tampa, Florida, so it's not a real, strong labor history in Tampa, Florida. My parents were sort of true blue Democrats, more or less, but, labor unions have been out of fashion for quite a bit. And so there's not that... I mean, there is when you look for it, but there's not that same culture or unions don't have as much influence, at least that I could see growing up in where I grew up. But then when I came back, I was sort of interested in it and it seemed like an interesting to do. I mean, you should always get, and if you want a grad student to be part of your organization, you should get them early, make it harder for her to back out. And then, so I got involved and really liked bargaining team. Because we'd, survey members, see what people wanted to do, and then, come at sort of an adversarial process of a bargaining table, which, it was interesting to see the process. You read such negative things about what labor unions do, and when you actually sit down and what you do is, we bargained for lactation rooms, so that women would have a place to nurse, right, which is something people had asked for. People really wanted to get rid of segregated fees, these sort of...
Mm-hmm.
Fees are tacked on they're sort of ballooning out a back end way to raise tuition because it's so hard to raise tuition because they have to go through the legislature. Little pay raises and things like that. It's all like little tweaks. It's all little it's kind of jockeying for a position.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got involved. And then few years later, I guess that's 2010, so that's, yeah, 3 years later, I ended up as co-president, because I'd been the vice president of bargaining before, and, yeah, for a few different reasons, we, Alex and I decided to run, Alex Hanna was the other co-president, decided to run for a co-president.
How do you spell Alex's last name?
H-A-N-N-A.
Okay.
So we... Yeah, decided to try it out for co-president. We had been on the executive board. We felt comfortable with the organization,
mm-hmm.
and really cared about what it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So the first bit of your term was sort of dealing with the sort of expected
pretty standard stuff, yeah.
Duties, and then when did things start to change?
So Scott Walker was elected, and TA had been sort of marginally. Into the elections, I think we had done phone banking and stuff like that, and we heard about what might happen was the Thursday before Monday was February 14th was Valentine's Day, and the Thursday before that we heard that Scott Walker was going to roll out these things. We had heard from our union contacts in the AFT that here. You know, he had laid out some bullet points of what was going to happen, and it was like, you know, no contract bargaining rights for state employees. And it's in that sort of mixed language of you can only bargain over wages and something like that, which basically means, like, you can't bargain because there's no, you know, there's isn't really bargaining power if you don't have, like, things, you know, multiple things to bargain over,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can only bargain over the amount of toilet paper in the guest in the men's
room. Okay. Single or double ply.
Yeah, that's an unfair comparison, but it certainly was like really like cutting basically the function of unions for representing workers, cutting them off at the knees to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And other things about collecting dues, which is also huge.
Mm-hmm.
Making it, you know, less than a fair share of state in some way. If that means anything to you guys. There's a fair share, fair share and a right to work state are
okay.
the two
oh,
ways.
Oh, this is the... Okay.
Yeah, so fair share, if everybody comes in and at one point in time elects to have a union, then the union then has the power to collect dues from all the members, whether
mm-hmm.
or not they sign a card. And before the university or the state would automatically take out those dues from the paycheck and pay the union. And a right to work state is you have to sign the card and opt in. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So Thursday you start to hear these. Thursday, that would have been the 11th, if I'm doing my...
12th.
No,
the
10th. The
10th, right.
The 10th.
We heard Thursday night and we're all kind of freaking out because we know that means a lot, but there's a lot of uncertainty. A lot of uncertainty with that. And then, so we're planning, and I was actually gone that weekend. I was going to a friend's wedding or something. Like
okay.
I forget what I was what I had to do. But some people had planned to have this, because we knew Scott Walker was pretty anti-union and was kind of a, I wouldn't even say budget hog, but, you know, he wanted to limit government, you know, small
yeah.
government, Republican. And so we knew that was happening, so people had come up with a campaign to the I Heart UW campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be Valentine's Day.
Mm-hmm.
We had gotten a lot of people to sign these cards, and we were going to deliver these cards to the governor saying, I Heart UW, please don't take away the funding for UW. You know, public schooling is good. And then it became like a bigger thing because now, like, oh my goodness, this is a big deal. We actually know his agenda and his plan, and it's would have what we think to be a lot of negative impacts to the state. So then that Monday protest where we were would walk pretty standard, walk down from Library Mall up State Street
mm-hmm.
that connects right to the Capitol. On that day we, you know, gathered around Memorial Union and about 1,000 people turned up, I think. 1,000 or 1,500 people turned up. And the cops were like, okay, just stay off the road. And, you know, stay the sidewalks and don't block traffic. And the people had been more experienced in bigger demonstrations. I, myself, never having been part of a big demonstration, really, were kind of, like, chuckling a little bit. because the point is kind of to disrupt things. But, you know, so we went up State Street on the sidewalks. We had banners, and we had this little cart where we were wheeling all these I Heart UW things. And we, you know, so we went up, and everybody was chanting, but we didn't really know which chants to use because, you know, we weren't sort of seasoned and hadn't sort of prepared this to be that kind of thing ahead of time. And then, yeah, brought the cart up the stairs and sort of delivered it to the governor's office. But a lot of people had turned out because people had heard about this by that time. Over the weekend, I think the details were released and people were starting to get really worried. Yeah. So that was the first day. And then so we disbanded. We were really worried. We were thinking about doing some demonstration the next day and kind of had planned to do a similar walk. And the next day, I think we had double the amount of people. Which is, I mean, 3,000 people turning out or something is a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I'm mixing all the figures, but it was a lot. Yeah, it was a lot more people. And it felt more, and there was it was a gravity to what was going on. Mm. And the next day is when they had planned to sort of pass the thing by Thursday or Friday. Okay, this is up. This is totally going to change the social contract within the state. We're going to have it passed by Friday. You know, I was like, oh my god. You know, like, when does this happen? Like, why can't government ever function this?
Efficiently,
you know, something I care about. Yeah. Yeah. It just seems like the cards are against you, but it was this thing where it was like, oh, well, it's just sort of being changed in the budget. Like, how do you do that? You know, it was like the streamlined policies because it was a budget repair bill. Mm-hmm. So it was like, oh, well, we have this huge problem with the budget, so we're allowed to, you know, tweak some of the knobs a bit more than we would ordinarily. So they were taking testimony, and we were trying to turn out people, as all unions were, to turn out people to, like, take part of this testimony. Myself, not really knowing where that could go. I don't think anybody knew what exactly was going to, you know, nobody knows what's going to, like, percolate up. But we're sort of just doing what we know how to do, and a lot of that's from advice from more seasoned politicos and in AFT, Wisconsin. So having an umbrella union is really important, as it turns out, because they have the staff who can just know about politics and can sort of be tapped into who the right people are to talk to, whereas there's so much flux in our institution and, you know, we can't support full-time sort of political staff members. Yeah, so we just turned people out, and then we just had a full docket, and people wanted to give testimony all through the night, which is when we started to actually occupy the building, because they wanted to shut it off, you know, or say, let's come back the next day, and everybody was just riled, you know, and there was this, when we kind of knew that we were going to start sleeping there, was we were in this hallway, because they had sort of closed the doors of whatever room to convene, and the legislators were going to talk about it, and, you know, there are a bunch of hotheads in there. You know, not me, right? I'm super reasonable. But everybody was like, no, we want to keep, you know, we've got a full lineup. We've got people continuing to sign up. You know, there was this momentum to what we were doing. You got to hear our testimony, right? This is the way it is in Wisconsin. Another state, you couldn't have done it that way, because Wisconsin's required to sort of take public testimony over something, which is the only reason we were able to sort of sustain the thing, I think. Or at least it was, you know, it was the immediate impetus for the way things happened, I think. Because then we were just trying to turn people out. Okay, come in, sign up, you know, give your 2 minutes or whatever it is, and just fill it up. So people are sort of yelling in the hallway, and it's just sort of reverberating throughout the building. We're going to stay, let us in. Lots of chants. And everybody was so tired because we had been doing that most of the day. Or just, like, I think we started in the late morning or something, and we're just trying to turn people out and sort of run around the building, you know, in this, So then that's when it started, and that's what we kept doing for days. That's what sort of sustained
an
occupation.
You said that was Tuesday?
Yeah.
The testimonies? Okay, so Tuesday was the first day that you were really trying to turn people out.
Yeah, you need to fact check me on that, but Tuesday is when the occupation started to happen. The first protest was February 14th, and February 15th was Tuesday. And then they thought we'd pass the thing.
We won't quote you on that.
Yeah, no, quote me on it, but fact check me on it. This is an oral history, right? You're, like, limited by the bounds of my memory.
Right. And actually, this is all new to me, so this is really interesting. Okay, and then what was the physical space that the testimonies were being given or taken in? Do you remember?
I couldn't tell you the room number right now. I could certainly tell
you.
Just,
it was just a room in the Capitol.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a hearing room in the Capitol.
Okay.
There are two big hearing rooms. I think there's the... I mean, there's two big, like, legislation rooms. I think they're called the Senate hearing room and the House hearing room, maybe.
There's
the...
Yeah.
Not one of those. It was just this kind of a smaller room, and they'd let a few people in at a time, and you'd sit in the in your chair and wait for your turn to come up. And there'd be kind of a one of those big raised desks that the legislators would look down down at you upon. And so person after person like would come up and say, please don't pass this, you know, like, this is bad because, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just, you know, person after person, even if they weren't super politically active ahead of time, would sort of turn down, that this thing is terrible.
Wow.
Like, don't do this. Yeah, it was powerful.
And who was in the room listening to these testimonies?
Yeah.
Or was there someone?
Yeah, no, they had to.
It's not just like a filibuster.
They had to, you know, they had to turn people out. And legislators took turns. They didn't all have to be there, but legislators would take turns, and there would be some Republicans and some Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Who would be there, and then I think within themselves they organized to do it in shifts.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, so ostensibly that's what was letting us stay in the building in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Let me know if I'm giving too many details about things you're not interested in.
Sorry, I keep asking questions even though I know it's so interesting.
But that was, essentially that was what's keeping us in the building. They can't close the building if there's still testimony going on, mm-hmm. right? They can't chase us out. Otherwise they could. So we just sort of kept going. But after a while, we were sustaining that. But then after a while, it was sort of, I think the legislators or the police had sort of realized that it would have been a big problem to get everybody out of the building. It wasn't something that they were... that they wanted to do.
Yeah.
But they still kept taking testimony, and Democratic legislators worked in shifts, like having night shifts and stuff like that, to sort of keep it going. We kept that going for the first week, I think.
Whoa. Really?
Yeah. At first it was sort of like, you should only talk once, I think is the standard of what's going to happen, but I think a few people signed up again just to sort of keep it going.
Yeah. And why is that is that Wisconsin law that you if
yeah.
there is oral testimony,
you have to. At the time I knew exactly what the wording was, but you have to sort of if you're passing legislation, you have to have 3 days of to receive public testimony,
okay.
which is not true of all states.
Yeah, I think when the Senate's in session, they can't close the building
mm-hmm.
or something. Mm-hmm. That was also
Yeah, so all the senators had to keep turning out, or legislators.
Yeah.
It wasn't just senators. Yeah, they had to like keep session open, to keep the building open. Anyway, so that doesn't have a lot to say about the material history of the building, but that's what got everything started. And if you sort of ask, as you sort of alluded to in the beginning, about TAA's role and getting things started, or
mm-hmm.
whether TAA was sort of super central to making everything happen, I would say after a while the thing had momentum. You know, when 150,000 people turn out no, our tiny union of 2,000 graduate employees, you know, dozens of whom show up to meetings, did not do all that. But I think we did. We had a lot of capacity to mobilize people, to turn people out in the beginning. We had that first protest. We kept turning up, and after we started sleeping in the building, Occupy wasn't really a word at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The way it is
always
now.
Has trouble with
it's not like
yet.
A capital O
yeah.
At the time.
Yeah.
And we didn't call it an occupation, right? There's Occupy.
Mm-hmm.
The movement, but it's based on sort of occupying a building, not being able kicked out. We technically, in the beginning, we were on the up and up because everything was the session was open and things.
Mm-hmm.
So it technically wasn't really an occupation. It was like, well, we were sleeping there, you know, during an open Senate session.
Right.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so TAA's role was mobilizing people in the beginning, getting people to turn out, keeping things in line, keeping once more and more, and there were thousands of people staying, and certainly hundreds staying overnight. We get information to a lot of people, you know, channeled resources where it was needed. We're kind of like, we had a room that we were staying in the beginning before they kicked us out that had been reserved by AFT, in which you could call it like a situation room or the war room. And that's where I was most of the time with some other TA members to like have a Twitter feed and a website, which everybody was using at the time, how we distributed information and, yeah, doing that stuff. So we were in place to do a lot of that mobilization and to keep information flowing and to keep sort of butts in the seats at the testimonies. And so that was our, from my end, that was our big contribution, getting things started and being there consistently, having the most people, not that they were all TAA members, but we coordinated having people sleep there at night and cater to people's needs and stuff.
So did you stay the night then, or all those nights?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I slept there every night for the first week or two. And then after that, we would take turns. Alex and I would take turns, which was nice. I mean, because then we shower more. but yeah, I did a lot of sleeping there. Slept on the marble or on the carpet in that room in the Capitol. Yeah. Yeah.
What was, so the first night, were there sleeping bags? Did people know to bring like blankets and were camping out? Or was it just like lay down on the ground? I don't know.
Yeah. No, the first night was in some ways the most exciting, right? Or at least at night, there was the most energy. I mean, for a couple of weeks, I only slept 2, 3, 4 hours a night. It was very taxing and tiring. And it just felt like there was this need to sort of keep on top of things, right? We had to sort of, everything was sort of in flux. Oh, the governor's going to bring in the National Guard to like kick us out, because supposedly he had prepared the National Guard. I never actually heard if that were true, like they were staged in some place. Or, oh, the police are coming in riot gear to do something like that. And one of our main jobs was to like field rumors, ask somebody about them and have them say, no, none of that is true. Mm. You know, but it's a rumor mill when you have thousands of people in one place and they're all sort of just feeling very paranoid about what's going to happen or how long this sort of flash in the pan is going to last, you know. What was your question again? It was about
the first night.
Oh, the first night. Okay, so the first
people came prepared. Or?
No, the first night we didn't know. We just turned out to like testify, and from my point of view, you know, you might get a different answer from different people, but me, it was like, oh, okay, we've got to like, yeah, let's just keep going. Oh, well, let's stay here tonight. You know, people are riled up. You know, let's make that happen. Okay, let's. People are offering us food. You know, well, let's figure out how to get pizzas in the building and. So we just stayed there, and people weren't really prepared. We sort of, it was real exciting because, you know, you slept in the rotunda, and the second floor of the rotunda is where I remember sleeping. And everybody just sort of like, you know, lied against the wall. But there wasn't a whole lot of sleeping being done. But yeah, there was this energy to it, like, oh wow, we're here, what is going on, you know? Sort of thinking it might dissolve the next day or the day after that. The first couple, 2 or 3 days, it really feels like, you know, okay, well, let's do what we can. The thing's going to pass, but let's raise hell, you know? Yeah.
How did the organization of it change as the sleeping in it continued?
Yeah, well, go ahead.
Oh, just that I, like, read about volunteer stations of different things, and it sounded really organized, but what, I don't know, did it feel organized, or how did that evolve?
Yeah, from my point of view, it was very lateral. I feel like I get praise too much. Like, oh my God, Kevin did this. He was in the news, and oh, he was the president, so he like made it happen. You're like, no, you know, I didn't like do all that. You know, it was a really bottom up. Happened. You know, I was sort of a node where information would go through or would help facilitate things, but really, I think the organization. There's always a mix, right, of people who are in leadership saying, oh, well, let's do it like this and let's work like this. But, you know, oh, well, we're getting all this food and it's nasty here and we need to clean it up. Okay, well, let's set up a table. Let's have a food table. Okay. So we did that, you know, and then a few people were, like, in charge of food and did that. And we had this a guy, Mike Quito, who was a former TAA president and worked. I don't know if he works in the Elections Bureau or the clerk's office or something like that. Mm-hmm. At the time, he said the ladies' auxiliary, so he's a gay man, and a lot of his gay friends, each one of them would make a crock pot worth of like vegetarian soup, real food, the ladies' auxiliary at the TAA.
That is awesome.
And so we'd like have real food, because for a while, you know, when we first started, they brought this big thing of hot dogs that the Teamsters or somebody would bring, and they just found that a lot of us don't eat hot dogs, you know? And
yeah.
And then you're like, ah, sorry, you know, it's solidarity and all, but, you know, half of us are vegetarian, maybe. So it was like, oh, this isn't your, you know, everyday union thug,
so
you know? So it was funny. So we had sort of, then different food was coming in. Ian's Pizza, Mediterranean Cafe, so we're doing that. So then that became like a full-time job, right? And we were eating great food for free. We had great coffee. That's when I became addicted to coffee. I didn't drink coffee before.
Wow.
Yeah, I was more of a tea drinker. But then just if you sleep three hours a night, you know, like you need something. So they organized the food table. Then there was somebody who was realizing that people who were staying on the floor of the Capitol and there was a building, you know, a different group of people. They weren't TAs, they weren't necessarily union members, people who really cared about this issue. There was that drum circle, and I'm sure you've heard there was, like, drumming all through the day.
Hmm.
That was based there, and there was, like, a lot of energy right in the center of the rotunda. That those people felt isolated, and it felt like our situation room was this, like, top-down body that wasn't talking to people. And so it went from, you know, us being co-presidents of this small labor union of graduate employees that hardly does anything, you know, or like tries to stay afloat, get things done, to like, oh, you're big labor, you know, you're like the union folks and you're not letting people in, you know. It just felt like all of a sudden we've got this power, we're not really sure, or at least we've got a repute, and we're not really sure what to do with it. And you know, oh well, why aren't you, you know, when things like, oh, why aren't there more sort of minority and poor communities involved, or you know, why are we just talking about these issues and not other issues? And I was like, I don't know, you know. What do we know, you know? Like, it's just sort of like we're just trying to like respond to what's going on.
Right.
So when that kind of thing happened, there was a woman, a student named Harriet Rowan, R-O-W-A-N, who'd be an interesting person to interview. She wanted to have this information station, so she had organized to disseminate information that we were getting about the political things and what was going on. And she would, and they had a couple of volunteers, and they would either pass out flyers or walk around and sort of, you know, just let people know what was going on. And because if, you know, you're in the middle of the Capitol and there might be tweets and stuff going on, or like, you know, you hear ruffles or things going out throughout the building, but you're not sure exactly what's happening. So that ended up being important because, you know, we all needed to talk to one another. And yeah, and there was, like, little by little over time, it was like there was this animosity towards what we were doing, because we were seen as like orchestrating the things. And from our point of view, it didn't feel like that. You know, it felt like trying to stay on top of what was going on.
Hmm.
Other things that were organized, it was that. There was, I think every day, the police, the Capitol Police, would meet with people. So we had a member or two go to that. And Harriet Rowan was another person to talk about that. We had a really good relationship to the police. They said it was like, you know, the nice people protest, right? Only in Wisconsin would you have, like, all these people are, like, giving the cops a pat on the back and, you know, talking about what was going on. Oh, I really appreciate your job and you're doing what you're doing. You know, like, that didn't happen everywhere. You know, if you compare it to Egypt, which happened, you know, weeks before, and then Occupy, which happened later. There was always, there's always tension, right? But so every week the Capitol Police would meet and sort of talk about what was going on. And so we tried to respond, oh, okay, well, they're like, you can't have all this stuff out of here. You know, like the food or whatever clutter was building up. Or the cleaning staff just, they want to clean the building, so could you guys move off this floor for a couple hours? And I was like, yes, sounds great. It smells like feet in here all the time. You know? We will help you. And so stuff like that. And they felt... You'd have to talk to the Capitol. I mean, it'd be interesting. I'm interested to hear what, but they were a little pinned because, you know, they're part of the executive branch. So they're, you know, supposed to do, you know, things to sort of keep people safe. And I think the governor was sort of moving towards, let's get people out of here. You know, like this is no good. So they were in a difficult place. But then a lot of,
Because they're unionized?
Because I don't think all of them wanted to kick us out, but it was their job to do what they were ordered to do, and we weren't being kicked out partly because our numbers kept being high, but of course people were sort of jockeying to sort of figure out what would be the right time and place to do it, and way to do it, and it was hard because they had to have more shifts. I think they had to bring in extra people. They brought in, they were bringing in. People from the, I don't know if it was the Park Service, the DNR officers were coming in, and local sheriffs from other areas who were taking shifts. And so there was a larger police presence every time. That's an aside. But you asked about the organization that happened. It was mostly around food. There were events that went on, like those big events that people had to book ahead of time. I think that was done by AFT, AFL-CIO people. Coordinating food that I remember now, that's mostly what we were doing, and just information. You know, we had a couple folks who were on top of the website, or it got to be like our PR department, kind of, in which if we papers were calling us to like ask for interviews, and so they would okay, if you want to hear what the organization said, we have to talk to Alex and Kevin, because we're the ones empowered to speak for TAA, right? Mm-hmm. Any member can do anything. Like, oh, this guy's going on a hunger strike. What do you think about that? I was like, well, we don't know, you know. He can do what he wants to, but that's not what we're encouraging people to do, you know, that kind of thing. Well, our union has, you know, decided on these things. So we had people doing that, releasing articles on the website Defend Wisconsin, and making sure that our tweets that went out, which were, you know, really being followed by a lot of people, were relaying the right information. Those are the things I remember. Yeah, but it, to me, it wasn't us saying, this is a problem, you do that, you know. There was a little bit of that coordination where somebody had to make a decision or something afterwards, and we had to do a lot of that. But a lot of it was, hey, you guys are not doing this right. I think you should do this. It's like, okay, great.
Thanks.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Then... So when in the stay, or was it after the stay, that the damage account, like that number, I think it was $7.5 or $7.4 million.
Which was bumped down to tens of thousands of dollars. Yeah. Mostly to the grass, I think.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we can't help that. Yeah. We got to replace the side, you know, like taxpayers, yes.
Yeah. But when did that get released? Was that while you guys were staying inside? Or?
Well, we knew that towards the beginning, I talked about those meetings they would have with the police, and so we're like, okay, well, what can we do, you know? And they would tell us a few things like, oh, these guys are acting up, or, you know, some people are just being antagonistic. It's like, well, you know, they're protesters and you're the police, you know, sort of the deal. But another was that people, posters were going all over the place, right? I don't know if you saw photos, but they were like on all the columns and people were hanging things from inside the rotunda. It was awesome. It was beautiful in some, you know, street art way. But I think people were using packing tape, you know, the clear plastic packing tape, or shipping tape, whatever you call it, scotch tape, all different kinds. And they said, so they were like, you know, we're really worried about the marble, right? The glue from those can seep into the marble and sort of dissolve the marble, and you can, if when you take that off, you can take off kind of a chunk from the marble, is what we've been told, or it's what I understood is the worst thing that can happen.
Who was the source of this information?
The police told us. The police told us, yeah. Okay. So it was like, well, we don't want to do that, you know, like, we love this building, you know, we love this building more than anybody else probably right now. So even though it smells like feet. but we said,
it's going in the paper.
You know, so we yeah, apparently foot smell does not dissolve marble, but because otherwise, man. So we tried to take them down very gingerly. We AFT was connecting us with supplies, so we needed medical supplies. We needed some people wanted sleeping masks or, you know, some blankets people donated. And we would ask for, you know, food was just coming in regularly, so after a while we didn't have to ask for things. Mm-hmm. But every now and again we need supplies. And so asked the, it was AFL-CIO who was delivering us supplies and just run to Home Depot and get us and said, we need as much painter's tape as you can find, the blue painter's tape. So just get us reams of this stuff. And so we did that, and little by little, we said, if you put a sign up, use this tape, right? And it was everywhere, all this blue tape. And we sort of gingerly tried to, like, remove the other ones, take the other tape off, put it back on with the painter's tape. Yeah, because it really mattered to us. And, you know, we were there to, like, make a political statement, but I think at that time, I think this is a testament to how much we started really, certainly I started, and other people were really caring about the state. Towards the middle of the protests, and as they were going on, it was like, oh, I just felt like a Wisconsinite, and you know, being from Florida, and I'd been there for a few years, so I really liked Madison, Wisconsin, but you could put a finger on what I really liked about the place, and the way I connected to it, and what I valued that was being threatened by this bill, you know. I think that tape discussion sort of incites that in my head, or those sort of like very powerful feelings for me, in that it wasn't like it just we didn't live in the place anymore. We were fighting for it, you know. We were fighting for something we saw as integral to the Wisconsin experience, or the type of place we wanted to live in, and this bill threatened that. And the type of place we wanted to live in had really nice marble columns, so let's take care of them, you know?
Yeah, say a little bit more about what, by that point, you started to feel like you knew to be true for yourself. You felt like that. You said, I knew it by then what I was fighting for.
Oh, yeah.
Say a little bit more about that. That's interesting.
I guess often we just grow up in a place, right? So I grew up in Tampa. Things I really love about Tampa, and I connected to the people. And it felt like this was the first time I had to fight. It's probably not totally true. But I really had to fight for the place, or to fight for something that meant something to me. Wisconsin's labor history, affordable public education, the power of institutions, of strong institutions, a progressive history within the state. Those things that I've been steadily learning more about and still have a lot to learn about, all of a sudden had a gravity, maybe naively or ignorantly, had a gravity to them because we were fighting for these things. Oh, okay, we're passing by that statue of Fighting Bob and all these sort of posters of very progressive politicians that sort of litter the inside of the building, and to me, I connected to that political history, to the TAA being the first graduate assistant union in the country, right, and having contract bargaining rights. But in a way that's Wisconsin, right, in a way that has a strong sense of place, that has these sort of lofty principles like the Wisconsin idea or the way that institutions are supposed to serve the people. And I thought, I saw that as very much in threat to this talks of austerity and the, you know, representation of labor unions and other organizations I'd come to have just a profound respect for, that I wish were in other states, right? That I wish other people could benefit from, yeah, the relationships to their institutions and their government were sort of being under threat in this place and in this area that was much more home to me now than it had been before I had to fight for it.
Is that where the our house, our house came from?
I don't know.
When did that?
Whose house, our house?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whose house? Our house, you know? It was awesome. That chant and this is what democracy looks like. You know, tell us what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like. We're all over the place. Like that one, people would even like honk it, like down the street for months.
Wow.
I'm surprised they don't still do it. Months they would like...
Wow.
Yeah, and everybody like raised their
voice.
Yeah. So whose house, our house? I mean, I'm guessing that comes from somewhere else, right? It wasn't invented here. But at the same time, it was this idea that we were staying in a public building. This is how I think of it. We're staying in this public building. You don't get to decide who is comes and goes from the building, you know? This is our government, right? This is the government of the people, and we belong here. So, yeah, you kind of felt like direct tie to your representative democracy in some ways, because usually we don't, you know? We vote, we move on with our lives, you know, and do what we need to do, and right now it felt like, to me, the first time I actively participated in my government, you know? We all do, right? A government is made up of all of us in lots of different ways, but this was like, no, you're not representing us right. You need to, you know, you need to, like, hear what people are saying. And that's, to me, that was the impetus of what we were doing. After a while, you realize, oh, when you occupy a building, the media comes, and, you know, and then you can occupy for longer because it's harder to, like, chase you away. Like, oh, great. Funny how that works out. I didn't know that, you know. But I'm not, like... I didn't have this wealth of sort of lefty knowledge of social movements and protests and things going into it. And I think we, during that time around Egypt and then Occupy with us, we were realizing that, or at least our generation was sort of realizing, well, it's about sort of stirring things up for a little bit, and the media follows, and then your message gets heard, right? It's about sort of staking your claim for a while, but until, you know, that knowledge of media and the way that they take over, until that happens, it's a little easier to do away with you.
Have you been to the Capitol since then and, like, walked through?
It's changed, yeah. It's real powerful to be in there for me. It's a beautiful building to begin with, right? It has this grandeur about it. The super high ceilings and the... just ornate murals and multiple colors of marble. That was all impressive and awe-inspiring before. But now, as you know, you move around, when I walk around the Capitol, it's wearing off now after a couple years. But you remember that day that it had 150,000 people walking around in the square around the Capitol with all their funny chants and great signs and the drum circles of what was inside and all this activity that was going on, where you're at this epicenter of something big, what felt like something big in the world, an historical event. And so I think being the weight of the Capitol, to me, has that inside, that more than all those other things, it's It's what it felt like, the energy that it had on the inside. Some of the other lived experiences of smelly feet and loud drums until late in the night, mm-hmm. and chatting with people and sort of what the marble felt like when you were running around on it, because we had to be sort of dashing from one place to the other quite a bit. Smell of pizza. Those things still kind of linger for me. Feel of the carpet when you're sleeping on it, you know. Because in those rooms, we slept sometimes in the room, sometimes on the marble.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think those experiences are certainly wrapped up in the Capitol and will always be there to a certain extent. Yeah. We had this one, if I can tell an anecdote, which is the whole point. We had this one time where...
Storytelling, Kevin.
We had a meeting with the chancellor. All of a sudden, the chancellor wants to chat it up with us. Yeah, of the university, Biddy Martin.
Before she left for...
Yeah, yeah. Well, at this point in time, let's not go into all that. She had policies she was trying to pass at the university. And if you're the chancellor of the university and, you know, a large segment of your student population is staying in the building or involved politically in what's going on, and the rest of the population is affected by what's going on, and we had teach-ins. You hear about those? We didn't have strikes, graduate students. We had lots of general membership meetings at the time. We didn't have strikes or any, which people throughout the state were very hesitant to do. And we got flack for other people, you know, were like, if you can't hold a strike during this, then when can you hold a strike? It was actually kind of difficult to hold a strike in the U.S., or at least in our institution. You know, you have to get full two-thirds of members to sign up for the thing, and usually it's time-bound, and most strikes you should have, you know, a demand for what's going on, and are we willing to do that? And people in general are very hesitant to sort of strike, and yeah, but then we won't be teaching. The students will suffer if we don't strike. And I think it was a lot of teachers and TAs and other people who were like, you know, why should the students suffer for our sort of political trials and battles? And there are lots of great arguments against that, you know, lots of good arguments for it. So we didn't strike, but we had these teach-ins in which TAs would either cancel class or teach off campus. You wouldn't teach off on campus. And we did that, I think maybe Thursday and Friday of that first week, maybe Monday, Thursday, Friday, Monday, maybe. We were supposed to sort of at least stir things up a little bit, right? We weren't going to ask all professors to cancel classes and stuff like that. And TAs are really worried about, you know, like drawing their students into something, and their students are there to learn, and we were providing a service to students. Anyway, Biddy Martin. We're going to talk to Biddy Martin down at Memorial Union. And so we had coordinated via email. She wanted us to meet at her office, and I was like, well, let's meet somewhere in between, you know? And so we went there, and the Vice Chancellor, Paul DeLuca, was there. I think his name's Paul, yeah. And a couple other people. And so we went to talk about stuff. I think we had in our minds that, well, maybe you could cancel school on Friday or Monday or something. And I think they were checking in to see what we were thinking. I forget the substance of the meeting. But we met a couple times. And we were coming down, and I think that was the first Saturday or the next, or Friday or something like that, and there were 150 people on the square. And so we had been sort of stuck inside, and I was coming out with one or two other members and a staff member of TAA. And we came outside, and it's beautiful, bright outside, still cold. But it wasn't too cold, so the sunshine after being on the inside, right, there aren't like a whole lot of windows and natural light always coming in. People were sort of running around chanting. They were when I came outside, they were singing Solidarity Forever. It just made my hair stand on end, because people really meant it, right? Solidarity, this word, this kind of lefty propaganda word that often doesn't mean very much, meant something. And it really resonated at that time. People were singing it. And so we were walking down State Street to go to it, and they had this demonstration of union cab drivers. So all these cabbies were driving up State Street, and we're going to do a roundabout within the Capitol Square, and we were like giving high fives to people down the street. It was so energizing to be outside running and walking around rather than just sort of like hold up over a computer, just sort of within that bubble, this bubble that is very sort of taxing in a lot of ways, emotionally and physically taxing to be in there. Mm. That day was awesome. It was just like, it was like awe-inspiring, and it one of those moments that after you reflect on it, you know that it wasn't going to last very long, or there are very few times in your life where you'd be that inspired by the events you were living within. And by the time, it was just, let's just absorb this. How great is this? Can I just, feel that all over, that energy sort of coursing through your veins and all those little high fives and things. I certainly remember those very vividly. Mm. Felt good.
Mm. Nice. Having walked down State Street, I can picture it, though I don't know if my picture reflects reality.
But. Can you hear the horn?
Yeah.
People running along the sidewalk. Yeah. Oh, so many people. I mean, it's like an unimaginable amount of people that like fills the square,
Yeah.
That's like such a wide square, and
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's it for my question. I mean, is there anything that we didn't ask about that you want to share?
Yeah.
I feel like is relevant, regardless of our project or just
right,
in general.
Yeah.
To sort of your memories.
No, I was thinking of your project. One is it's a bit disorienting to be in the building. If you think about how the building's built, it's so symmetric that you're like, oh, it's on the northwest wing, which is in this one, after a while. And so I am easily disoriented. I always take a left when I should take a right. Mm. And so it was like, oh, it's on the northwest wing. And after a while, I knew what that meant. But in general, you can't really, once you're in the center of the rotunda, you can look at the little, directional markers, but you sort of have to run around. Oh, it's in the Senate hearing room, so you run around the way you thought it would be, like, oh, it's on the other side, so you sort of walk around. And I found that so fun. Well, fun because I love just running around, But I was like, oh, more running, okay, that's fun. But, sometimes you needed to be a place, and wanted to know where you were going. So it's a bit disorienting because it's such a symmetric building, right? And you have it's on the square, and it's sort of built around this certain plan of the way things went. The other thing about, so you have those really high ceilings, and they had everybody was in the center of the floor in the basement, first floor, basement, that's the first floor, right? Anyway, and so they'd have drum circle, and it would just resound throughout the building. You're just like, burr, 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 because it was, hippie drum circle. And after a while, we sort of were like, okay, after 10:30, we'll stop the drums after 10:30, 11, midnight, something. something not 4 a.m., Because people would play
generous.
Drum like crazy. But it really, because of how the building was built, right, where it's like spokes off the center, all those drums were just present throughout the day. I can't think back to experience that I was going throughout and not think of the sound of the drums resonating throughout the building. It was a soundtrack to our lives at the time, as much as the chants. There was one. Yeah, you talked about the damage accounts that the governor was putting, and part of it was just to shed us in a negative light. Oh, these crazy protesters, And a lot of it feels like the political discourse is about slandering, slander's a bad word, but saying something negative about your opponent, and then that takes over, right? That gets hold in the media, and then so they think, oh, well, what are the people doing there? Why are they still there, And there was a lot of that, Once you got a little bit outside of Madison, people were, didn't really get it or didn't really connect with what you're doing, or he's our governor, we elected him, we stand with Scott Walker. Maybe we didn't vote for him, but You know, so when we did recall elections later on, we're doing some canvassing, sort of realized that, oh, this didn't have the gravity in people's lives it did for us. We knew that was true outside of the state, right? Because you assume.
Mm-hmm.
But also within the state, you know, it was like something that was happening in Madison for some people. Like, as big as it seemed to us, it's humbling in a good way to sort of step outside and think, okay, it was important for a lot of people, and a lot of people knew why it was going, or could intellectualize why they thought it was going on, but that doesn't mean, you know, it resonated with everybody, even the people who weren't, you know, right wing or, you know, behind Walker the whole time.
Yeah.
There was one other thing I was thinking about, the space and the way that it was arranged. On Thursday, you know that the senators left the state, right? Because they could be required to go to session. And there were enough Democratic senators that they wouldn't have quorum. I think they only needed one Democratic senator to get quorum to call the bill into question, call for a vote, and then pass the bill. And so they decided, some people disagree with that decision, but at the time we didn't, you know, still needed something to help, I guess, people realize. And so, because this was in the first few days, And so it was that first Thursday, the 17th, we had heard that there was one senator who was still in the building. And we were, like, angry with this guy because the Capitol Police, you know, if they say, look, if you're in the state and you're in the building, they can say, look, you have to come to session, right? It's your job. And so we had heard they were still there, and so then that, everything would be over, right? So after the first 3 days, right? 4 days. So we thought they were going to call it a question. So it was like, so we heard this information from our AFT folks, and they were like, now you know. And it was like, oh my God, what do we do with this, you know? So we decided that we would try to organize a sit-in that would blockade the doors to the Senate hearing room so that even if they did get the guy, they couldn't get him in there. And, you know, so we had to go around and talk to people we didn't know very well and say, okay, there are three doorways. There are two main doorways to get in the Senate hearing room. And apparently there's a back doorway that we don't know about, or still the architecture of the building eludes me, you know, because we didn't have like a...
Says me too.
We didn't have like a blueprint of the building to say, oh, okay, these are the exits and entrances, and it's not like you can Google that and look it up, and we had to make a decision right then. So it's like, okay, there's probably a back door because, you know, duh, there should be a back door or fire exit or something like that in case somebody wants to stage a sit-in and block all the exits. There's probably a back door, and so we were trying to figure out that information, but we're going to stage a sit-in so that people couldn't get in. So there are two big hallways, or there are four entrances to the Senate hearing room, if I recall correctly. And so we had set people on, like, the first floor and then the second floor. So we'd coordinated, you know, went down, I remember, like, running downstairs, you know, and I asked a few people, hey, can you, like, come along with me so it looks like an entourage or something, you know, maybe I'll carry weight. And so went down there and said, you know, I have something to say, and somebody had a bullhorn, and they put down one of the buckets that they played drums on, one of the those plastic paint buckets or whatever, and sort of stood up on that and said, okay, here's what we know. There might be somebody in the building. And if they're able to call it to session, there's pretty much nothing we can do, right? And they're going to pass the thing, which was called, yeah. It was a budget repair bill at the time. Ended up becoming Act 10. They're going to pass the thing, okay? So what we're suggesting to people what they do, right? What we'd like to do, what we think would work, would be to sit to block people coming in. And just so you know, you know, here is the potential of things that can happen, right? You can, to get arrested, you can, if the police ask you to leave and you leave, nothing happens. If the police ask you to leave but you don't do anything, they can drag you away. Or you could also say, like, no, I'm not going to leave. Okay, well, I'm going to arrest you, and then they will walk you away, you know, and you, mm-hmm. you know, agree to walk with them. Or you could say, no, I'm not going to leave, and then they have to drag you. Mm. And there are different, there could be different consequences for those different actions. Like, those are, that's what could happen. You guys all need to know that. But we're going to do this, and you guys sit down. We'll make sure we get you food and water. And we'll try to, like, keep information going. And so people did, and of course they were disoriented. Which way is this in here? You know, how do we find that? Right. And so then they sat down and blocked the exit. And then so we're trying to figure out, are there other exits? How is that working? And then we heard, like, some people are letting people, other people in. And I was like, well, that's not the point, you know. So don't let people in. It's like, well, some people aren't letting people out. And it was like, let people out, you know. It's like, you know, so we had, yeah, so we sort of, we're running around, yeah. sort of screaming, like, okay, there are two rules, you know, nobody gets in. And the second rule is everybody gets out, you know, if anybody wants to get out, they get out, right? But we then got flack for that, because then the press, the people weren't letting press in, because we didn't have, like, one, you know, access entrance, where people were reading IDs or something, but... You know, you gotta make simple, you know, you gotta, like, just
You're
sort
thinking
of,
on the fly.
Yeah. And I figured that out. I was like, okay, we'll have one entrance where people can check to make sure their press credentials are okay or something. Anyway, it did never pan out, but a lot of the way that ended up going, and then so we were running around trying to get the information, going hoarse at the time. But a lot of how that went had to do with sort of the layout of the building. She had these four entrances, and it was like a nightmare for siege, this type of siege warfare type thing, because you had so many entrances and they were kind of wide, and you weren't there was this uncertainty about what doors went where, you know. Mm. So this is a big sort of complex, like, building with all these little rooms and little places. Yeah, that was a really powerful day for me, because one, it was asking of people to do things. We were running around. They were asking people to break the law, to possibly break the law, and knew that there would be negative consequences, and a lot of things we couldn't control, that people could get arrested, and it was something that we had at least suggested that people do. And just that sort of maintenance of something that was more than just sleeping and staying over. It was a bit more, you could say, hostile. By the time, I was like, well, we need to keep this thing going. That was our whole, our impetus, or at least what we thought is, okay, we're going to stay in this building until somebody kills the bill, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what we've got to, like, that's what I had my mind on, whether people did, whether or not we had formal demands, but, okay, we need to, you know, we need to stay here until we kill the bill. And that may not be possible, and there's a lot about the democratic process that we don't understand, but, yeah. So if that's your goal, then it's like, well, we got to stop them in some way. But then apparently the guy was there or hadn't reported to people that he had left the state, or maybe he was and he jumped out of a window and left, you know, absconded or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
So that's the other spatial story about the place. Right. That's all I can remember for now.
No, that's great. Yeah, that's great. I'm impressed with your sensory memory as well as, in some ways, actually, those are probably the easier details to remember than sort of chronological. This happened on what day?
Yeah. I think that's really fair. That a lot of these things were at the time I could, like, spit out. Okay, this is this type of civil disobedience. This is this type. Or, okay, well, this legal thing pertains to this other legal thing.
Right.
But certainly, and that's what a lot of the accounts about the Occupy movement and some of the criticisms about it and some of Wisconsin is it's a lot about personal experience of these things. Mm-hmm. We have so much of that, that it's, and a lot of social theory that goes on around it.
Mm-hmm.
That in some ways it can be too much about just the organizing effort and not really about, I don't know, the politics or moving forward.
Mm.
And sometimes we're too wrapped up and infatuated with our experience of the protest. Mm. I don't know if that's true, but I see why there's so much of that stuff coming out, because it is inspiring. It feels like something you want to write about. It feels like you want other people to know and hear about, because it has such a big impact on your life. Why so many people connected to it, and why there are a lot of people who became activists during that time and stay that stuff, and that's involved in their identity because of the gravity of that time.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, what are, I think you said political stories or something. I mean, what are some of the stories that you feel like you wish you saw more of in the media? Either at the time or now? Do you feel like there are, I don't know, like parts of the experience that are just uncaptured, if there is this sort of...
Yeah, I think the criticism, if it wasn't clear about it, was just that people are too... We have too much out about what the organization of Occupy is about and what this other thing is about, and we don't understand the politics of it very well, or that it's not clear about what the whole aim of the thing was. I think the same in Wisconsin in some ways, in that part of it is about, we're standing up to the man, and it sounds like propaganda and is a first-person account in some way. I don't know, I mean, how much this belongs on a history, but certainly... we do have a lot of that, a lot of those accounts, but we're still with Occupy for sure, and with this protest as well. I think history is yet to be written about what this means, what this will mean in the long term. Right?
Mm.
It's clear to me. It's clear the impacts that it did and didn't have. Right? If you were to judge the success of a movement or of an action, and that. Act 10 was eventually passed. We were not able to recall the governor. A lot of things that sort of like ticks in the lose column kept racking up. But how those... And those things are hard to change, right? It seems like you can remove contract bargaining rights in 3 days, 4 days, 3 days of testimony and a vote. But to get them back takes a long time, in my understanding. Though you could have, a benevolent dictator governor who could, pass the same kind of budget repair, but what we need are more human rights, and that'll fix our budget.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I don't know. I think that stuff still isn't. Well, we may, for years, we won't understand that of the long term impact it'll have, not just on the material, sort of actual political changes of the state, but also the sentiment within the state and where the politics will go from now.
Mm.
Because what actually happened was we have much weaker unions. We just laid off 2 TAA staff. A lot of unions in the state are having to combine, so that they can pool resources more, or just realizing they're never going to have the stream of income because of some of those things from Act 10. So we've got weaker institutions, And if something similar were to happen, a similarly objectionable bill were to happen now, we wouldn't have a lot of those. It couldn't happen the same way because we don't have those institutions that sort of were in place to sort of make things happen.
Mm.
And I'd stand by that you may not connect with your union. Or you may not even be part of a union or some of these big organizations, and there's lots of criticisms of them. But at the same time, having those institutions there benefits us all. One of the benefits is having the structures in place that people can jump into when they're motivated, like a Obama campaign or a Romney campaign or these protests. Some people may have never been to a TAA meeting before, but now they, are getting involved in some of the activities.
Mm.
So that is one of the big impacts that, we all worry about.
Mm.
On top of those lived experiences that are also significant.
Right.
Significant to a bunch of people, but may or may not be, have the same consequences that the actual you know, the political consequences and story that played itself out may have.
That's really interesting. I mean, it's also just personally interesting as I think about sort of not the paper, but general political worldview.
Yeah.
So that's interesting to hear someone think through and talk through.
Yeah, I think there's been lots of good articles about that.
Yeah.
Occupy
yeah.
is in love with itself.
Yeah.
The Wisconsin protesters are sort of in love with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, still all the things that a lot of people who participate in Occupy and participated in the protests here are still around and may have gotten worse.
Yeah.
That's humbling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so true.
If nothing else.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I feel like that suffices to answer my questions,
yeah.
But I don't want to speak for you, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I think so. I guess that was one thing I was wondering after that. You were talking about, like, the clear things that would have gone in the loss column.
Mm.
But were there clear things for
in the win column
that came out? Or
look at you.
Well,
that is a good interview question. The win column. I think we certainly collectively revived, in some ways resuscitated, if only for a short period of time, progressive politics in the state. And we gave, I think it inspired people to get more involved with activism, to appreciate the value of protest and of direct action and civic engagement, some people who may not have been so convinced beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
That the role of the citizen changed a lot, at least for me. You know, I grew up in the 80s, you know, 80s, 90s, you know, knots, not necessarily times of a lot of direct political action in the U.S., you know. Whereas my parents, who, you know, may have sort of, I don't know if they would have discouraged me to be involved with something like that beforehand. You know, they're pretty sort of run the mill. You know, you should, you know, don't cause too much trouble, right?
Mm-hmm.
Care about that stuff, but, you know, don't get arrested and, you know, try to push that down so you can get a job, you know? That changed a bit. That you have a bunch of, a generation of people, you had high school students who turned out to this, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of high school
mm-hmm.
students, because mm-hmm. teachers did sick outs, and so there are a lot of like high schoolers that turned out, and oh my god, it brings me to tears. Look how awesome that would have been as like a high school to be involved with something like that, to be developing your political self and to be part of this event during that time. It's inspiring to me that they would grow up and think, yeah, this stuff can happen and this matters, and you know, we should get involved. You know, we shouldn't just scoff whenever we get political phone calls asking for contributions. Like, yeah, that stuff's annoying, but, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that hopefully will last a while. I think people saw the value of a strong labor movement in here and in the country. Of course, not everybody, but, you know, a lot of people saw what unions were capable of and some of move beyond some of the regular criticisms of what unions do. All these are sort of ideational win column because we haven't had many others. Getting Obama reelected, some people might argue that wasn't a win for the progressive movement, but we'll see. But certainly politics have been moving to the left in recent years, and our protest was part of that, I would argue. Yeah, from a personal standpoint, it was a win for me in that it made me admire myself more, respect myself more. Oh, I'm capable of doing some pretty cool things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was involved in, throughout my whole graduate career, that was probably, or like through my life, I guess, right now, that felt like it was the most substantive contribution that I made to affecting society and in a way, or you know, like sort of following my vision of what a society should be like, and then following through on it, and even if nothing comes of it,
mm-hmm.
like, oh, okay, yes, I inspire my own self, you know, and I think a lot of people feel like that own personal experience of getting involved in a just it feels empowering, you know. I can do this stuff. I don't have to like think that somebody out there is doing it. So if that carries on, and we're just even a small part of that, that's cool. That's a win.
Mm-hmm.